You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm. We are here in the studio today with Mary Morris, who will be our first guest. Her new novel, The Waiting Room, has appeared in hardcover from Doubleday. And we will be talking during our second segment with Michael Goth, the owner of Phoenix Bookstore in Santa Monica. Mary Morris was a writer who I'd read Vanishing Animals and The Bus of Dreams, and she appeared at Beyond Baroque to support Alice McDermott, who'd come down to give a reading. And I said, oh, Mary Morris, I've read your books. And she was teaching that semester last year at USC, and we kind of became friends, a difficult friendship, because it involved the fact that the bookworm doesn't drive. The Morris has a baby daughter. They were living in Orange County, I in Hollywood, and a lot of flummery went on before we finally spent a kind of picnic day at Forest Lawn Cemetery. Now, I did not propose that we spend the day at Forest Lawn. However, you know, normal it might seem to the listeners that I would propose such a thing. It was Mary Morris. What made you want to come out to Forest Lawn? In fact, I think it was your second time there.
Yeah, it was my second time at Forest Lawn. You know, I'm not exactly sure. I began doing research, Michael, on a book about California, and I wasn't really sure exactly where the research would take me. But I started getting interested in the whole facsimile aspect of life out here, the fact that, for example, at Medieval Times restaurant, it's like a, you know, I don't know if any of you have ever been to Medieval Times, but it's sort of like a jousting pit, and you have dinner while wenches serve you. You know, Disneyland. I was sort of interested in the whole notion of theme park in American culture and what it really, I mean, what it says about the American dream, what it says about America, and Forest Lawn with its replicas of the baptistry doors and other things just sort of fit into that.
It was kind of funny because reading The Waiting Room, your new novel, I found myself lifting up one finger to scold. Anyone who's been to Disneyland and takes Disneyland seriously knows it's Sleeping Beauty's castle, not Cinderella's castle.
Yeah, I actually know there are Disneyland mistakes there. I apologize to my California readers for that. It is the character's drug trip, actually, at that point, so I gave her you know, permission to get a few things wrong.
Yeah, that's pleasant.
My New York copy editor did not get the Disneyland stuff right either. So.
Well, you know, a whole generation of people who read, you know, family novels, which The Waiting Room is, will reach, you know, its brief California section and say, Sleeping Beauty's Castle, Mary. This is an interesting book because set in the Midwest, in Chicago, essentially.
Yes.
It's a kind of folkloric or fabulistic description of a family as it goes through three generations from, is it World War II?
Well, it's actually earlier, if we include the grandmother's generation, it's really from the sort of pogroms in Russia until the war in Vietnam. 1975 is the present time of the novel, so it's about 100 years.
It's very interesting to me because suddenly dynastic novels,
yes,
as they're called, are coming back, most of them flying under the banner of Marquez.
Right.
And so Amy Tan's book,
right,
recently.
Which is a wonderful book, and I just loved it, yes.
The Joy Luck Club, the Louise Erdrich books.
Right.
There's been a kind of American wing of magic realism. And
right,
this book is particularly interesting because it combines the two. There is the feeling, the cover is a picture of an Edward Hopper painting, that The Waiting Room is an odd cross between a kind of naturalism on the one hand, a kind of grainy naturalism,
right,
and the kind of creamy dreams of family and mythology that Marquez,
right,
produces. How did that Well,
actually, I think if, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the writers that you just named, Marquez and Amy Tan, are writers whose work I just profoundly admire and in Marquez's case have been influenced by. I think that really the book represents a kind of evolutionary process for me, and I think I probably would have even gone more in the magical direction if I had evolved quite, you know, that far in the writing of the book. It was just, I think, a point in my evolution, and I hope the marriage works. I'm not sure if it does at all times, but there were certain things my editor had trouble with, but I decided to keep them in, so...
It was an interesting thing. Joan Didion, sort of writing about the beginning of this efflorescence of Latin American magic realism into the American mm-hmm. novel, implied that in some way it didn't belong there, mm-hmm. that Americans, in choosing magic realism, were opting for magical thinking, the childlike misunderstanding of the world that was leaving out actualities, practicalities. And she found this to be part of a movement in the world where people were preferring to remain as children instead of mm-hmm. developing mature and wizened attitudes toward things.
You know, I think that's really interesting what you're saying, because I've had my own feelings about that and perhaps even a little guilt. Just as The Waiting Room was coming out, I took an Amtrak to Washington, and I was coming back through Penn Station, and they built this beautiful new sort of exit ramp from the Amtrak, and it was simply filled with homeless people, each of whom had a sign, "My house is burned out," and all that. And I actually had that thought right there, like, how can I write fable-like fiction? How can I write magical realism when this is the reality of America? On the other hand, in this particular book for me, I mean, it was a book of my remembering. And so if it has a childlike, fable-like quality to it, I think that's why. But I think that Didion may be correct in about America, that the magical realist perspective is, in fact, a kind of denial of the realities of our society. But also, I mean, the Latin Americans have some pretty grim realities in their society also, and I think Marquez is one of the few writers who's been able to combine the harsh political realities of his culture and at the same time blend it with the magical realist voice.
Well, it's very interesting because he seems to have a pattern, one magical family book followed by a grim book
right.
of foul magic, the magic of the dictator.
Right.
And so now that he's done the Love in the Age of Cholera, the next book I read is once again The Labyrinth of the Autocratic State.
Right.
It is very interesting. What I fear myself,
of course,
is
Didion, Didion is really a hardcore realist writer. I mean, and I do understand where she's coming from and why she is saying that. I mean, it's interesting that magical realist fable like voice came out of Latin America, where the politics is so much a part of their lives, so much more so than for us.
Mm-hmm. I fear exactly in the way you're talking that the only way we'll be able to assimilate the homeless will be to romanticize them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one can imagine magical realist novels in which Mark Halpern-like
right.
homeless people live in tunnels under the earth
right.
and make nightly escapades. It really does ask an interesting question of what role reality is playing and how reality
mm-hmm.
is being shaped.
Mm-hmm.
Didion likes the guise of being wised up, but there's a price for it.
Right.
There's a kind of almost romantic tough cookie
right.
in the sound
the
of
the street
her prose.
Smart writer.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I personally have trouble with that kind of writing. I mean, I guess I'm more interested in a certain kind of lyrical quality, a certain kind of style. It's just more appealing to me. And I have been moved enough by such novels as House of the Spirits by Isabel Allende, which is certainly a magical realist novel and I think quite derivative of Marquez. But, you know, the last 50 pages about torture in Chile will knock anyone out and will certainly put that novel in another, you know, it's not a simplistic magical realist novel by any means.
Now, the turning to Latin America has been quite a movement in your own writing career,
right.
beginning with The Bus of Dreams, a story in which a bus goes around, is it Mexico?
Where no, it's Panama.
Panama.
Yeah, it's the buses of Panama that, I mean, I was in Panama 3 days, and somebody told me this about the buses in Panama. They're all beautifully painted. And this guy told me that the bus drivers in Panama own their own buses. And when they get a bus, they take it to this bus painter who paints their hopes and dreams on the bus. And I simply could not let that image, you know, if I got nothing else out of my trip to Panama, it was that image of buses being painted with people's hopes and dreams. And so I wrote the story, The Bus of Dreams, you know, about those buses.
And then you later returned to live in Latin America.
Actually, I lived in Latin America before the trip to Panama. That was later.
Oh, I see.
I was the guest of the United States government when I went to Panama. But I lived in Latin America in 1978-79.
And the experience became your memoir, A Nothing to Declare.
Right.
The memoirs of a woman traveling alone. Now, you mentioned that you in an interview that you might be going back to do memoirs of a woman traveling with child. Is this
when did I say that?
I'd read it in one of these many papers.
Maybe I did. Yeah, maybe I did say that somewhere. Well, let me just say one thing about travel and writing and memory and all that. I mean, for me, moving around the world and geography has just been a really important part of my life as a writer. And it's just always fed my stories and my imagination. I've always drawn from my journals. But I do have a child now, and so I kind of drag the child around the world with me. And this summer we're going to spend the whole summer in the Southwest, so, and hopefully plant it for periods of time. And, you know, my traveling has changed. I mean, I'm no longer getting on Latin American buses and just sort of wandering through Honduras. You know, it's a little more, AAA is planning my trips these days. So.
It's an interesting thing that that finally, having, you know, made the descent into South America, this book is a North American novel, but it brings back with it a kind of South American point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of fascinating thing, and I enjoyed, it was interesting. Now I would enjoy the turns of plot, and then on the other hand, I'd find certain moments of syntax so folkloric that I wanted them to stop, like he sang to her of his drunken father. And I'd say, oh, please let him sing about his drunken father, not sing of his drunken father.
Mm-hmm.
Were there times in the writing when the magical elements would not fuse with the family elements?
I think there are times when things wouldn't fuse, and I also think that I must have written this book in a very romantic frame of mind, and I don't mean romance in the sense of boy-girl. I mean a sort of, I don't know, a kind of vision of the world that's what one would call a romantic vision. And I kind of wish now that exact phrase that you're mentioning is something that I wish I had read more of the passages of the book out loud to myself and sort of heard them for myself. I think the answer to that is yes, and I think that sometimes maybe I got a little carried away with the extremes of emotion.
Well, it was very interesting to me because sometimes I'd be completely lost in the book, as one does get in the stories of families and also in fables.
Right.
And then at other times I'd be catapulted out and have the external observer's eye, a kind of writing critic eye saying, oh.
I may have to have you edit my next book. I just think that every once in a while things get away from you, you know. And, you know, if I could have, I would have written 100 Years of Solitude, but I'm glad someone did.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on my California novel. It's actually evolving, but I have piles and piles of research about California, various aspects of life in California, and also Vegas. I'm interested in the Vegas-LA connection, and I'm interested in the notions of hitting the jackpot, gold rush, and also the New Age. So I'm kind of combining all those things in a sort of strange way.
Well, I remember when you were here, you were getting permission to sit in on an interview with Whitney Strieber.
Right.
And
visiting.
Right,
yes. Extraterrestrial stuff, yeah.
Uh-huh. People from, what was it? There was a princess of some other galaxy that you had met.
There were various extraterrestrial groups that I was involved with, and certain ones had claimed to have extraterrestrials present in the room who simply inhabited the bodies of what appeared to be humans. So I attended several of these things. I'm actually trying to take that research out of the book and really turn it, as I said a little bit earlier, more into a book about the American dream and about the search for connection and family, and leave the New Age a little bit behind. because it's, as many people have said, it's too easy to poke fun at certain aspects of it.
It's interesting. Your books have a tendency to be wistful and sometimes even wistful and romantic. Mm-hmm. And I guess many people accept as the California version of things the play it as it lays reality.
Right.
Do you find that that is characteristic here in this land of dreams? The only way to talk about it is harshly?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm actually writing about this part of the world during the 1950s, so most of the book is research, and it's kind of a period piece. I mean, I think if I were writing about it now, I'd have to say, yeah, that there is the play it as it would be kind of a play it as it lays quality to it, but I don't feel that I really know California well enough to write about it from that point of view.
The waiting room just
I think I'm writing another fable, is what I think is happening, Michael. God help me.
The waiting room just out from Doubleday is a family novel. Is it your family?
Well, I think elements of it are my family, but I mean, the only person in that book that really comes directly out of my family is the grandmother. And the stories and things that she tells really are pretty much stories that my grandmother told. But I don't think, I mean, my mother is much tougher than June, and my father is much more there than Cal, and my brother is certainly not damaged in the ways that, you know, we all have our problems, but he certainly isn't a draft dodger, former drug addict type. But I think in the way that all families, you know, that every family is similar, I suppose it is in a certain sense my family.
I like the interesting mesh of generations, and I guess I thought that the fable things worked particularly well with the grandmother, with mm-hmm. Naomi, and I was charmed at those moments when fable and history would intersect, mm-hmm. as when remembering having been buried under the earth, hiding from the Cossacks in Russia, she later goes to see Houdini do one of his famous escape acts.
Right.
And the fact that Houdini was Jewish and her own past sort of brought that moment to a kind of fullness.
Right, the Jew as escape artist.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Did your grandmother see Houdini?
No, that's all made up. My grandmother never saw Houdini. And
I wish she had.
Yeah, I wish she had too. But, and I mean, the thing about the graves, I mean, I do remember my grandmother telling me, and I believe it was in her life, that her mother did have these little graves dug for her children so that when the Cossacks came in, she would put the children in the graves. This is how I remember it, but I'm not sure that it's really true in that quite that way. But that always stayed with me. I mean, she probably told me that when I was 8 or 10 years old.
Mary Morris, I want to thank you for coming here and talking with me.
Thank you, Michael.
It's really a pleasure to see you again. No, you should
be off the air.
No, we should be out here. You should be out here more often.
Well, I'd love to be in California more often.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Michael.
And then our paths crossed again in a more intimate or direct way when I came to his new bookstore, the Phoenix Bookstore on Santa Monica Boulevard at 5th and Santa Monica, and came to work for them. The Phoenix Bookstore was put together out of some of the personnel that had made the Westwood Bookstore so beautiful, and it had as its emphasis metaphysics. I was very nervous, really, because the one thing I'd been warned about California, it came from Pauline Kael, was, well, you can go there, she said, and you'll have a good time, but stay away from metaphysics. Mm-hmm. Well, here it was, grabbing me by the throat. The time had come for me to take a job. I used to work in bookstores then, and it was the Phoenix Bookstore that I worked at, very near my house at the time. One of the things that I remember was wondering how I would ever be able to advise people about which crystal to buy. But the bookstore had a kind of bicameral quality. While it had all of the New Age literature anyone could want, on the other hand, its collections of psychology and philosophy books were impressive, arcane, difficult. It's the place that many people come to find works in philosophy and criticism that you wouldn't find anywhere else in L.A. How did the idea for a New Age and philosophy psychology bookstore come about, Michael?
Well, it's always been part of my life. I have a degree in history from Bard College. My reading there at Bard was heavily into philosophy and psychology, so it's an interest that I myself have retained. And at the same time, 15 years ago or so, when the store was originally founded, incidentally, in Riverside, California, in 1971, at that time, my interest in theology had sort of moved in the direction of the so-called New Age. It's just simply an interest of mine, an ongoing interest, the philosophy and the psychology, and as well the New Age and metaphysical.
Did you find a confrontational pattern in the early days of the store between the kind of university people who would come in for the so-called serious stuff and the people who were looking for information on candle worship?
The larger question is really a question of prejudices, and I think one will always find that regardless of you'll always find bookstores, for example, specializing in Railroadiana, and somebody is walking in for the latest Jackie Collins. But seriously, it's a question of prejudices. What we're talking about here in the so-called New Age is really a question of a lack of prejudice, whether we can see in a variety of different areas, perhaps. Whether we want to describe them as inner states or inner states of being. Psychology, for example, might be, in fact, for many years was thought of as being an arcane subject. We find some people there that are still somewhat inhibited by the name metaphysics, that's true, but we're moving to the 1990s. Globally, there are some sweeping changes, and we're very happy to see them.
Well, it's interesting to see how certain ancient studies have returned in different forms, and so that the Phoenix bookstore, which has a wonderful mythology section, finds that that mythology section enters the studies about the goddess that are part of women's studies. There is an interesting resurgence of Joseph Campbell's thought, and so people are going to the mythology section to learn more about the kind of thing Campbell is talking about. And so in many cases, the New Age material and the so-called ancient or more serious material are the same.
Well, this is very true. I think the Campbell explosion, as it were, points out yet another element, and that is that New Age or Old Age, when we have our children growing up, putting them in front of the television with the kind of fare that's available there, they're open to something that touches the psyche, touches something in a greater detail and depth, perhaps. I don't know. It certainly seems somewhat archetypal. We're very happy. We're very happy to see that. We could also say, for example, that the interest in the Kabbalah, where 15 years ago when this store started, I know that some of my friends, Jewish friends, rabbis and so on, would just dismiss it out of hand. Now we have rabbis coming by. Where can I get a work on the Kabbalah? I have to be able to talk to these people that are bringing these new ideas. So whether it's mythology, studies of Kabbalah or ancient, let's say, Neoplatonic thought, we're seeing a resurgence of interest in that. Not that the interest has never really died down, but it's part and parcel of the so-called New Age as well, absolutely.
It's been interesting because one of my friends told me that now with the Campbell interest and the fact that George Lucas acknowledged Campbell in the formation of the Star Wars movies, many film executives have at their desks Xeroxes of the patterns that Campbell talks about in the belief that these are classic stories and that the story must have the hero who departs with the killing of a father, who gets a playfellow or guide, who experiences an experience like death and comes back. This is becoming
movie language. Mm-hmm. It's sort of funny. Well, what about the death and transfiguration of the hero, BJ?
Absolutely. Well, we find that many – we have a strong section there on screenwriting-related works, as you might know, and many of the screenwriters and would-be screenwriters. That book, Hero with a Thousand Faces, you're referring to, which is now 40 years old, published by Princeton in 49, the best-selling academic backlist title by far, contains all the elements of a good story, I suppose, in this town is what they would say. But, mm-hmm. But yes, absolutely, the archetypal elements are there. And they're being sought after for a variety of reasons, I think. People feel a certain lack in their lives today. There really isn't too much of substance out there, and they're looking in other areas, and mythology and related fields of study are very very welcome to them.
What's the address of the Phoenix there?
Well, we're down by the ocean. We're at 514 Santa Monica Boulevard, which is down near 5th Street, and we're open 7 days a week, so gives people ample opportunity to get by our store.
I shouldn't probably say that there are often authors who come and give small seminars at the Phoenix, including Carlos Castaneda. Secret I'm letting out of the bag.
Okay.
This will cause zillions of phone calls to come. But it is mm-hmm. true. Castaneda has appeared at least twice. Is it that right?
Well, more than that, but on two separate occasions, as it were, over a two-year period, yes, and we were very delighted to have him there. He's an extremely interesting man. We've also had, Michael Crichton, most recently Frank Waters. Many people were introduced to the Native American culture and spirit, an increasingly important aspect of our represented in our stock is this wonderful interest in the Native American spirit. Michael Crichton, of course, has been by, and just we had a wonderful book signing with him. Some wonderful people, fortunately, and then other people. We're very happy to see, for example, Martin Sheen, who came in. We're fully supportive of him in his recognition of the plight of the homeless and related situations, both here in Santa Monica, in the United States, and of course globally, we're seeing great, wonderful changes.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting because the time I spent at the Phoenix, working at the Phoenix, 2 years, represented a passage that brought me from disbelief in everything to a belief in virtually anything at all, including my own happiness. It's very nice to be able to have a bookstore like the Phoenix in Santa Monica that has the range from university presses, arcane in one way, to occult presses, arcane in yet another way. And I'm glad that someone like Michael Goth has taken the responsibility for creating such a store. Thank you very much for being with us, Michael.
You're welcome, Mike.
This is Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. The producer of the show is Melinda Siegel. Our engineer has been Bob Carlson. We'll see you next week on The Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
And say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Clock Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.